Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest will be Acadia Tucker. She is a regenerative farmer up in Maine who has just released a book in March and has another one coming out next week. And so she will be joining us in just a little bit, and I'll tell you more about her when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways that you can get involved, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. First off, I want to share that I Eat Green, a.k.a. me, I'm doing a cooking demo next week on Thursday to celebrate National Food Day. And the cooking demo is at the Port Washington Library, but I will be joined by Patty Wood from Grassroots Environmental Education and her daughter Maggie Wood, one of the co-owners of the Golden Earthworm Farm, to lead a discussion following a film screening of Food Evolution. And every year we try to make people aware of National Food Day by discussing food and how it affects our climate and our health and our environment. And so Food Evolution is a great film, focuses a lot on GMOs and the problems that GMOs cause. So I hope you can join us, and then, of course, I'll be doing a cooking demo. And I'm also gearing up for my annual Thanksgiving feast for those that are less fortunate. And every year, you know, I used to call it Thanksgiving feast for the homeless, but I realized after many people made notice that, you know, many of the people aren't homeless. They're just in need. They're in need enough that they are willing to wait hours online, not only for a meal, but for the mobile food pantry that the Riverfund Food Pantry, which is the nonprofit organization that we partner with, they bring to the park. And we also do a huge Coke collection and winter warm items like sleeping bags and blankets. So we bring all that down to the park in Jamaica, Queens, always the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And it is a huge event. We feed about anywhere between 700 and 1,000 people. There's always extra food that we then bring to local food pantries, not food pantries, I'm sorry, local shelters. And it is a wonderful experience, not only for the people that are on the receiving end at the park on Tuesday, but it's really an incredible experience for those that participate in the preparations. We actually rent a refrigerated truck that sits in the parking area of IE Green, and it is a refrigerated truck that we just load up day after day after day. Last year we cooked 80 turkeys. This year I'm sure I'll cook just as many. We get so much produce donated from local businesses and a produce company up in the Bronx. They send a lot of produce to us as well. We get apple pies delivered down from Lyman Orchard in Connecticut. You know, so many different organizations and companies participate to really make this event just an incredible one. But families show up, students show up, teachers show up, community members show up. Some women cook turkeys at home and bring me a cooked turkey if they don't want to do the cooking here, and that really helps as well. So it's really a community effort, and it goes from, you know, 8 in the morning on Saturday all the way until, you know, probably 2 in the morning, Tuesday morning, and then we get up at 6 and start heating all the food up. We had like 80 flats of food that we're heating up. We have a local commissary that lends us their kitchen for heating up a lot of the food in the morning. And then we have a moving truck that shows up at 9 o'clock that morning and with guys, and they help us load everything up into the truck. So, like I said, it has turned into a really well-greased engine, and it is just a wonderful experience. So there are sign-ups on my website if you want to participate. I have to limit how many people can come each shift because my home is not that big, but it is certainly a wonderful experience. So I hope you can join us for that. Some other great things going on in the area. There's a Food and Climate, the Way Forward panel discussion being sponsored by North Shore Land Alliance. taking place at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on October 28th. It starts at 6 p.m. It is a free event, but they are asking you to register, so you can go to the North Shore Land Alliance website under events and register there. Food Tank is back in New York. They are having their summit and gala dinner at NYU Skirball Center for the Performing Arts on November 1st and 2nd. There's a price range for tickets, so go on to the Food Tank website to find out more information about that. I also do have links to all of these on my website. If you want to go to just one website, you can go to iegreen.com and scroll to the bottom where events are and see what's going on. On November 1st through the 3rd, there's a weekend retreat called Remembering Who You Are and Maximizing Your Potential with Maria Michael. Maria Michael was a guest on my radio show a few months ago, talking about an event she did here last spring and then this upcoming retreat. And Maria Michael is a Lakota shaman healer, and she's just incredible, and she's bringing her knowledge and wisdom to this weekend to work with all the individuals that show up for this retreat. So you can go to Maria Michael's website to get more information, or you can, again, find the link on my website. On November 7th, the Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group is having their It Takes a Region conference. And every year they have this huge conference that brings all the different agricultural organizations together under one roof to talk about how to move our food region forward. And so this year it will be taking place in New Jersey City. You can go to the NESAWG's website, which is NESAWG.org website, for more information. November 8th through the 13th is the 7th National Farm-Based Education Conference in Baltimore, which is also wonderful. If you're interested in farm-based education, which I am very interested in, it's great. I went to one of their conferences up in Vermont, and it was wonderful. The 14th Annual Thanks Living Feast is happening at the Woodstock Farm Sanctuary, November 9th. Check that out. And also on November 14th is the big protest rally at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for vaccine freedom. This is being sponsored by the Vaccine Injury Epidemic website, and it's a big event from 12 to 2:30, trying to bring people together. I mean, vaccines has been in the news so much lately, and whether you believe in having a vaccine or not, freedom of choice is what's really at stake here. As a human being, I have a right to make my own decisions about my own body, and having mandated vaccines is really questionable. So if you are in the area or you can make it down to that, it's definitely a worthwhile protest to participate in. November 14th through the 17th is also the 9th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference that is taking place up in Southbridge, Massachusetts. And then I've talked about this before, Climate Wednesdays, they've been going on at the Brooklyn Public Library. Coming up on November 20th is Parenting in the Age of Climate Change. And then again in December, on December 11th, there's a Climate Wednesday where the title is Green New Meal. And for the Food Climate Connection at the Brooklyn Public Library, there will be a panel discussion with Nancy Romer, who's the founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, Onika Abraham, who is the executive director of Farm School NYC, and Elizabeth Henderson, who leads up the Policy Council at NOFA New York, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And I am the moderator. So come down to that on December 11th. It should be really a great event from 7 to 8:30. It is also free, but you can find out more information about that on my website. And save the date for NOFA's Winter Conference, January 17th through the 19th. It will be up in Syracuse this year, so a bit of a trek if you are downstate in New York or Long Island, but the conferences are always worth it. They're really, really great. I wrote a couple things that I'd like you to all take action on this week. One is helping to get rid of shaming students at public schools or even private schools. When, you know, kids can't pay for their lunch, sometimes they're deprived getting lunch. And we just got to not allow that to happen. You know, kids deserve to eat even if their parents can't pay the bill. So there's a petition for you to sign on that. And there's also a petition to keep the integrity in organics. I actually wrote about this process called cow flipping, which is the process where industrial organic dairy farm, like Horizon or some others, might purchase a calf that has been raised not by an organic cow, but by an industrial cow, and then just brought over onto an organic farm, even though they have had have been fed items that are not within the organic standards. And so it's just a way that these large industrial dairies are competing and, you know, getting by through this loophole in the origin of livestock rule that is just not okay. And so there's a petition so that the small local dairy farmers actually have a chance to compete in this market, and also so that you know when you're buying organic milk, you're actually getting organic milk that is truly organic and that is of a higher quality than what's coming out of, you know, Costco organic or BJ's organic. So also a few weeks ago I wrote about the big article that talked about red meat and that the scientific research suggesting people cut down on red meat was not warranted. And it has now come out that the lead scientist in that study does have ties to the meat industry. And years ago, he was actually called out on writing an article. It was a similar study about sugar. And he was saying that the health guidelines advising people to eat less sugar was also not scientifically warranted, and that it had nothing to do with obesity. It was really exercise that had to do with obesity. So he was called out on that, and it's the same scientist. And so, like I have always said, you need to follow the money. You just can't trust, you know, an article, even a headline, and that's the problem. It's like they do a big headline, people see it, that's what they want to see because they want to keep eating their meat. So they say, ah, it's good. And, you know, we really have to fight that. And you hope that newspapers, journalists do their job and actually check the sourcing before they publicize an article like that. But nevertheless, they're being published all the time, and you need to really look into who wrote the article and really do your research. The Grocery Manufacturers Association is the despicable huge organization that is backed by Coke and General Mills and Pepsi and Nestle and all those big, huge mega corporations. And they were responsible for the defeat of the GMO labeling law that people were pushing for in California. And the Grocery Manufacturers Association has always been out there to influence the public, not for their better good, but for the organizations they represent. And there's been, you know, no transparency. They've been, you know, pushing back all over the place. Well, many of those mega corporations, because of the backlash from the public, have withdrawn their membership from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And so Grocery Manufacturers Association is now closing down, or I should say rebranding themselves. They're going to have a new name, Consumer Brands Association, or CBA. So we now have to start looking for that. They say that their mission has changed. Their new mission will no longer be an aggressive anti-transparency, consumer-be-damned attitude. Instead, their new mission is to advocate for uniform regulation in recycling rules, improving packaging sustainability, building trust in consumer packaging, and improving supply chains. And all I can say to that is they have a lot of work to do to to get back my trust, although they never actually had my trust, but to earn my trust, because I just don't trust these big corporations. You know, just so many of them are all they really care about and all they are feel responsible to is their shareholders and their bottom line. And I am not about that. And I think we all need to really do what we can to push forward to make our world better. And we need to fight for transparency. We need to keep the integrity in organics. We need to care about our environment. And as I always say, we all need to get involved. So please, please find something you're passionate about and get involved. I want to share with you my weekly recipe. This is pumpkin soup. This is what I will be making this coming week at Glen Cove School as my new position for as the farm-to-school coordinator. I'm interested in introducing a new vegetable, and I really struggled with this as to whether I wanted to just give the kids a piece of pumpkin, you know, roasted pumpkin, so they could taste what the actual pumpkin's like, or if I wanted to turn them on to one of my favorite recipes of pumpkin soup. And everybody in the school was rooting for the pumpkin soup because kids love soup. So I'm making a pumpkin soup, and this is also one of those recipes that I go to a lot of times when I'm making soup for a large crowd, because you just need one big pumpkin, and you can feed, you know, anywhere from 12 to 20 people with this, and even more if the pumpkin's larger. So I started with one 8.5-pound Long Island cheese pumpkin. So anywhere between 8 and 10 pounds would work. I looked for a Long Island cheese pumpkin because that's a especially delicious heirloom variety that's very sweet. But any pumpkin will do for this recipe. 10 cups of water, 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 1 tablespoon of minced garlic, 2 tablespoons fresh minced ginger, 2.5 teaspoons salt, 1 onion, 4 carrots, 4 potatoes, 1 can of coconut milk, 4 tablespoons maple syrup, 2 teaspoons cinnamon, 1 tablespoon cardamom, and 2 teaspoons coriander. And I started by laying out the pumpkin, and I cut it in half. I scooped out the seeds and the stringy center, and I saved the seeds for planting for next year. You can also roast some of them because there's way more than I can plant. So you can roast them if you'd like. And I put them, I oiled the parchment paper, and I laid the pumpkins face down. And I put a couple slits into the pumpkin just to allow some of the moisture or the steam to escape as it's roasting. And I roasted it at 375 for approximately 1 hour until it's soft. But just keep your eyes on it. Halfway through, you might turn your pan around if your back of your oven is much hotter than your front like mine is. So just watch it, and then after it's cooked, you can remove it from the oven and just set it aside and let it cool down before you try scooping out the pulp. Meanwhile, in a large stock pot, you're going to saute the onions and the potatoes. You can chop them up a bit before sauteing them, and the carrots as well. And saute all the vegetables in the coconut oil with some ginger and garlic. Add the spices to that and lightly toast those for a couple of minutes. Then add the pumpkin pulp. And so you go back to the cooled pumpkins, and you're going to scoop out all of the insides of the pumpkin, leaving the skin behind. And then you're going to put that into the pot and add 10 cups of water. I usually add 10 cups of water that I already heated up in my tea kettle just to get the soup going a little quicker. But either is fine. Of course, I use filtered water. And the pumpkin should be covered with liquid by about 3 inches. And you're going to bring that to a boil, then reduce the heat and let it simmer for 30 minutes until everything is soft. Then you remove it from the heat, and with an immersion stick, you're going to puree the soup until it's smooth. You can return it to the stove, and then you're going to add the can of coconut milk and stir that around. If the soup is too thick, you can add a little more water. Then you're going to add the maple syrup and taste it, and you can adjust the spices, whether you want more cardamom, more cinnamon, a little bit more maple syrup. Depending on how sweet the pumpkin is, we'll decide whether you want to add more sweetness to it. And that's really it. It's such an easy recipe. It's delicious, and it's going to be a challenge making it next week for 3,000 kids, though. So wish me luck. If you make the soup, please let me know. I love hearing feedback from all of you on the recipes when you make them. And so now it is my pleasure to introduce my guest, Acadia Tucker. Acadia is a regenerative farmer who is currently living in Maine and growing hops to support the local craft beer industry up in New England. And in addition to being a farmer, Acadia is a climate activist and author. Her books are a call to action to citizen gardeners everywhere, and they lay the groundwork for planting an organic, regenerative garden everywhere. And her book, Growing Perennial Foods, A Field Guide to Raising Resilient Herbs, Fruits, and Vegetables, came out in March. And she has a new book scheduled to come out in the next week or two called Growing Good Food, A Citizen's Guide to Backyard Carbon Farming. And for her, this is gardening as if our future depends on it. And, you know, she'll talk to us more about that, but it really is. If we all grow food, we can really change our future. And before becoming an author, Acadia started a four-season organic market garden in Washington State that was inspired by farming pioneers Elliot Coleman and Jean Martin Fortier, who was a guest on my show many years ago. And while managing the farm, Acadia grew 200 different food crops before she decided to go back to school at the University of British Columbia to complete a master's in land and water systems. And so it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Acadia. Acadia, are you with me?
I am. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. I'm so excited for your new book coming out. And we will get to that in just a bit. But first, maybe you could just talk to us a little bit about how you got into gardening and farming. What was your inspiration?
Sure. So my farming career kind of started in college. I was doing a lot of coursework in ecology and, you know, how to sustainably manage our ecosystems. And I never really grew up thinking I was going to be a farmer, but I just got this amazing opportunity. A few friends of mine, we had secured some free land to start a farm on. And the opportunity was so good, we couldn't pass it up, even though none of us knew what we were doing. So we just kind of dove in. We read a lot of books because we were, you know, nerdy college kids who had no hands-on experience. So we started by reading everything we could find, and then, you know, the day came and we started farming.
And where was this?
Washington State? This is in northern Washington State, yep. So pretty much on the 49th parallel on the border of Canada.
Different climate than...
Very different than climate. It was actually, this is kind of what got me so focused on regenerative gardening and the importance of soil, because the climate there was such that in the summer we had 15 hours of sunlight, so the sun would just bake our soil dry, it would get hard and cracked. It was almost hydrophobic where it wouldn't let water in. And then in the winters we almost had no sun and so much rain that we would have a lot of drainage issues, water pooling up on the surface. So that was kind of our first, that was my first reckoning of how much climate plays a significant role in growing food.
Yeah, it really does. And so, you know, now you're talking about climate victory gardens in your new book. Can you talk to us about what a climate victory garden is?
Sure. So we all know that we're kind of in this large climate crisis, and the thing that pains me and makes me heartbroken.
Some people don't know that.
Well,
or don't accept that.
If nobody's aware yet. No, we are in a, you know, the amount of carbon we're emitting into the atmosphere is wreaking havoc on our climate. It's making these climate extremes, you know, colder winters, wetter springs. It's really on a global scale impacting how our weather impacts us every day. And a lot of this impact happens to agriculture. And the heartbreaking thing for me is that large industrial agriculture is actually a big emitter of these carbon emissions. So it just breaks my heart because here's something that's so important that we all need, and it's actually one of the biggest players in this climate crisis because the conventional farming hurts the soil in a way where it reduces its you know, fertility. And somewhere between 50 and 70% of the original carbon stocks found in soil are actually released through poor soil management in agriculture. So that's things like tilling, using a lot of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, constantly turning the soil over, planting monocultures. All of these things actually contribute to the carbon emissions globally. And it's somewhere around 300 million metric tons through poor soil management alone in 2016 was emitted from industrial agriculture.
Wow.
So it's quite a big problem. So the fact is, though, that farming can actually make a difference. It's frustrating because we are dealing with an agricultural system that doesn't necessarily prioritize health, the environment, or climate concerns. But the good news is that farmers aren't the only ones who can opt for this kind of regenerative carbon farming approach, because many of us have our own patches of soil, either in yards, community gardens, even pots on a balcony can do your part. So my call is, you know, what if all of us kind of started caring for the soil in a way that we can actually be sequestering or pulling this carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it in our yards right behind our houses? So the idea of a climate victory garden goes back to the era of World War II, when victory gardens started sprouting up all over the country. And their goal was to support the war effort. The idea was that more food grown at home for the civilians meant more food that they could send to the troops abroad. So everybody rallied. There was posters hanging up everywhere encouraging people to grow their own food. They said things like, food will win the war. It was very patriotic. Everybody got involved. And by 1943, there was nearly 20 million victory gardens that were growing 40% of the nation's food, which was really remarkable if you think about it.
Wow, it is. 20 million gardens.
So 20 million growing 40% of the nation's food. That's how much we rallied together to fight this common enemy. And how I feel now is that we have this new enemy, and it's climate change. And I think that if we could do it back then, we can all rally together now to fight climate change. Because there's over 40 million acres of turf grass in the United States, and the average American household owns a little less than one-fifth of an acre in size. So just imagine what we could do if we all kind of rallied together and started caring for our soil for climate change.
That's amazing. 40 million acres of turf?
Yep, it's three times, grass accounts for three times more than all of the corn grown in this country.
Wow. Yeah, you know, lawns are such a silly thing, and yet you become so accustomed to them that, you know, if you don't have a nice lawn, I mean, one of the things that kills me is people with, you know, the automatic timers, and you see people watering their lawns, you know, during the rain.
Yeah, in the middle of the rain.
Automatic.
Exactly.
It's raining and they're sprinkling the lawn. So can you talk a little bit about carbon farming and how do plants draw down CO2? I don't know that everyone really understands.
Yeah,
when we say sequestering the carbon into the
right.
soil.
So around half the carbon released into the atmosphere, and that's through any type of emission, cars, farming, heating, energy, is absorbed by the oceans, by plants, and the soil. But soil does most of the heavy lifting because it stores four times more carbon than the plants alone. But we interrupt this cycle when we plow the soil, strip it of forests, spread chemicals on it, or just leave it bare during the winter. And this really does have terrible consequences because when the soil starts to degrade, the molecules that bind that carbon break down and release it back in the atmosphere where it becomes CO2 and other greenhouse gases. So carbon farming is a way that we grow food to grow food that puts that carbon back in the soil, and that's what we mean by sequestration, pulling carbon out of the air and putting it into the soil. And there's a lot of climate activists that, you know, promote expensive technologies that can do this. There's big smokestacks that suck carbon down and they inject it into underground mine shafts. But the thing is that plants do this for free through photosynthesis, so it's kind of fantastic in that sense. For people who don't know, photosynthesis is the process by which light is turned into plant food. So every morning when the sun shines, plants kind of wake up and they're stimulated to start sucking carbon directly out of the air. Now this carbon is shuttled through cells, it picks up new elements, but eventually comes to rest in the plant's tissue as glucose and starch, which is a very carbon-rich molecule. And over time, when plants, you know, wilt their leaves, die back, some of this carbon is naturally worked into the soil by soil organisms. But this accounts for only a very small fraction of the carbon that actually gets stored underground. The real sequestration happens deeper at the root level, because plants and soil organisms have developed this really special relationship where plants actually leak some of their sugars that they've created for themselves to feed soil organisms like bacteria, fungi, any kind of creepy crawly you can think of underground. In exchange for this free meal, they give plants access to nutrients that they otherwise couldn't reach. They actually help extend their root network to find more water, more nutrients. And when those creepy crawlies die in the soil, the carbon mm-hmm. that has made up their bodies actually just stays there if the soil is left undisturbed. So that the plant pulls the carbon out of the air, creates sugar to soil organisms, and when those soil organisms die, that carbon remains locked underground.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain plants that are more that pull more carbon out of the atmosphere than others? Like, are there certain plants that you recommend to plant to, you know, to sequester that carbon?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. And what I always say is that planting perennials is the best thing you can do for your soil in terms of carbon sequestration. And perennials are those plants that live for many, many years. So they might die back in the winter and you not see them, but in the spring they pop up on their own. And the reason that they're so good at capturing carbon is because they're in it for the long haul. They don't require, you know, annual planting where you're stirring up the soil to pop in new plants. They're very self-sufficient, and their root network is actually much deeper than, say, your normal annual vegetables like corn or stuff like that. So their roots go deeper, so they feed even more soil organisms. And since you're not yanking it out of the ground every year, it actually helps to develop a really nice, sustainable ecosystem that kind of works on its own, sucking and sequestering carbon.
Mm-hmm. Well, other than, you know, things like fruit trees, what vegetables are perennial? You know, I'm thinking of the vegetables that most of us like to eat, broccoli, cauliflower, squashes, greens.
Right.
What of those are perennial, if any?
So everybody's kind of favorite perennial vegetable would be asparagus. And they live for about 30 years, produce tons and tons of food. But then there's rhubarb, there's radicchio, there's walking onion, which is my favorite. It's kind of this long, shallot-like onion that creates these little bulblets on top, and when they get heavy, it bends and falls to the ground and resprouts and grows as a new plant. So that's why they call it a walking onion.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of my favorites. And then one of the lesser-known things is that some of our favorites, like tomatoes and peppers, are actually perennial if grown in the right climate. A lot of the climate in the United States does not work for perennial tomatoes or peppers, but if you can overwinter them. So back in Washington, I had my spicy pepper plant, and rather than start from new seed every year, I would cut the plant back to about 4 inches of the stem in the fall after it was done producing, and I would store it in my basement in a cool, dark place. And then when spring came about, I would take the pots out of the basement and put them into the greenhouse, and they would actually start to regrow just from that.
Mm-hmm. Right, but then you're still digging them up and planting them back. So it's not the same as a perennial that just stays in the soil, right?
That is correct, yeah. And there's, you know, there is a lot of wondering about whether if, you know, growing in pots or even raised beds can really do that much in terms of fighting climate change and storing carbon. But I always tell people that even if you're not getting the most bang for your buck, you know, and making your backyard this giant carbon sponge, growing your own food, even in small amounts, is still a really powerful act. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it means you make fewer trips to the grocery store, you might pay more attention to the seasonality of food. So instead of in the middle of winter wanting that avocado, you know, that comes from very far away, you might stick to the beets or the Brussels sprouts.
Right, right.
And it also, I think it teaches people to support farmers who embrace this sense of carbon farming through no-till, cover cropping, better composting practices. Because once you get a little taste of what it's like and the power behind it, I think it can really change people's perspective.
Absolutely. For me, the sad part is I don't go to the farmer's market anymore. You know?
Yeah.
I miss going to the farmer's market because I'm, you know, growing it all myself. But, you know, the farmer's markets are always fun. For me, when I travel, that's how I get to know a sense of a place. I always look for the farmer's market in the area. And so when I go to a farmer's market, it's usually when I'm traveling.
That's a really good way to do it.
Yeah, because you really do get a sense of the area by going to a local farmer's market. You know, it's like if you're thinking about where to buy a house or where to move to or whatever, you know, go when the farmer's markets are happening and see the vibe at the farmer's market, and you get a sense of the community.
Yes, that is a very good point. I when I moved back home, so I had my farm in Washington State, I moved back home to New England, and started the new farming project growing hops in Maine. But since I wasn't growing all my own food, I actually started to feel overwhelmed by the thought of having to go food shopping in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seemed very overwhelming to me, just you know, the lack of variety. Everything's kind of wrapped in plastic, and it looks
right.
like wax. It was very unnerving. So that was the motivation for me to quickly start my own garden up again. But, you know, as any garden goes, it starts off small and gets bigger and bigger every year. So these last few years, I have started going to my local farmer's market again, just to get that sense of real food.
Right, right.
And I try to,
you know, I'm doing less and less of catering stuff. So I don't, you know, I grow more than I can possibly eat. And so I'm giving it away, and you know how much work it is. And so my son's like, well, cut it back. You know, why are you growing so much? And I'm really thinking about just, you know, really, you know, going smaller next year and just letting it, you know, lay fallow for a year or two and giving myself a little more time. Because it does take a lot of time to grow vegetables. But what I think growing vegetables does also is it gives you such an appreciation for the work of a farmer.
Yes. Absolutely. When we would open our farm stands, you know, you have to admit that going to the farmer's market, you know, things do cost more. But when you start to grow food yourself, you can kind of understand why things cost more. And I think that helps people to realize that food should be valued more than it currently is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Acadia, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk some more about your books coming out and how you can help people get started. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. My guest is Acadia Tucker, regenerative farmer up in New England, and we'll be right back.
Gary Knoll, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Every Thursday at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Acadia Tucker, talking about Victory Gardens, Climate Victory Gardens. And for those of you just joining us, Acadia is a regenerative farmer from Maine who has two books coming out. Actually, one book came out in March, and she has another book coming out in the next week or two, called Growing Good Food, A Citizen's Guide to Backyard Carbon Farming. So, Acadia, before the break, I wanted to ask you, what are three good things you can do for your soil? Especially, I mean, we're now coming into getting ready for the winter. Is there anything you recommend people do, like if they're going to want to start a garden in the spring, anything they should be doing now to prep it?
Sure. So one of the things that I always think that it's easier to start in the fall for spring planting, just because it takes a lot of effort and you don't want to get burnt out. So what I always recommend is, so if you're starting from, say, a grassy patch in your lawn, I'd recommend that you mow down the grass to as short as you can. And then rather than digging into the ground, because as we've been talking about, that can release carbon emissions, I like to build my garden beds on top of the existing ground through a process called sheet mulching or lasagna mulching. So what that involves is a thick layer of cardboard, and preferably, nothing with a glossy coating. And then I just layer any organic material I can find, whether it be grass clippings, dried up leaves, seaweed, straw, food scraps, some compost, and then I cover that with a mulch of wood chips or straw, and then I just let it sit all winter long. So by the time springtime's ready, I have this really beautiful, fertile, fluffy planting bed without having to dig one bit.
Ah, and so you create a raised bed on top of the existing lawn.
Yeah, but over time, it starts off quite tall, and you might look at it and go, huh. But over the winter, it slowly decomposes and it shrinks. So it's only about, 3 to 6 inches above the ground. So it's not a classic raised bed, with wooden sides that most people mm-hmm. might think of.
Mm-hmm. And the things break down enough in the winter to, decompose enough in the winter that you can plant right into it in the spring?
Yep, and if it's a little bit still raw in the spring, what I do is I just rake back the mulch, and I'll just add another inch or so of compost on top, and then you can uh-huh. directly seed into that fluffy compost layer. And during the first year, it might be difficult to grow some, root crops like carrots and beets that need a little bit deeper soil to get started. Uh-huh. So I always recommend that people start with things like squashes or things that like really rich soil, lettuces, tomatoes, peppers, or plant their perennials directly into that bed, whether it be berry bushes, fruit trees, herbs, can just be plopped right into there. But then as your garden progresses and the seasons change, you just continue to nurture that soil by adding compost and keeping it mulched and minimizing how much you disturb it. So over the years, that, you know, leafy, grassy mass that, you know, was once your first bed, it actually becomes this really rich, loamy, perfect medium for planting.
Mm-hmm. And do you use any type of tool to loosen the soil at all, to break it up at all, or you just go right into what's there?
Yeah, so, you know, our winters, especially here in New England, are pretty rough, and the snow and the rain can you know, naturally compact the soil. So there's this awesome tool I use called a broad fork. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it's a heavy metal kind of U-shaped tool with a crossbar that you stand on, and it has these very wide metal tines. So what you do is you kind of jab this tool into the soil, and you stand on it, and you rock it back and forth. And what it does is the tines gently poke these big holes in the soil to aerate it, so that when it does rain, it naturally has channels to go through. So rather than using a rototiller, which kind of mixes all of the soil together, shreds through it, you know, breaks earthworms apart, it's kind of a very traumatic and tumultuous way to prep your bed. This tool, although it's a bit heavy, is much more gentle
mm-hmm.
on the soil.
Yeah,
I just bought myself one.
I'm so excited.
Did you?
Yeah, but I bought it in the summer, so I already planted. So I'm gonna, you know, use it for the first time, probably now, just a little bit before I put all the mulch and everything on top of it.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of a workout, but once you get the hang of it, and the thing that I tell people, you're always working backwards, so you're not moving forwards. You work the dirt that you once stood on. So you're working the soil backwards, if that makes sense.
Right, right. That's a good tip. So let's see, what else? Can you grow annuals regeneratively? I guess we touched on that.
We did, and a lot of the carbon farming principles focus on perennials because of their staying power, but especially for home growers, they don't want to give up the things they love, like, you know, cucumbers and radishes and things like that. It's unrealistic to say you can only have these awesome environmental benefits by only growing perennials. So I always like to stress that while annuals aren't as good as perennials from this carbon farming perspective, they're still an important part of the garden. So you can kind of counteract the negative impacts they have of the soil disruption by adding in a little bit more compost at the end of the season. And what I do is, instead of pulling the whole plant out of the ground, I cut the mm-hmm. plant off at the base, leaving all of those roots in the soil. And those roots will help anchor the soil so it doesn't wash away from erosion, and it will also continue to feed the soil organisms that, you know, have come to rely on that, you know, root mass underground.
Uh-huh. And so what kind of things do you do to prep your soil for the winter?
I always add a big heap of compost, and then the most important part is covering all of the soil with mulch. Because if you put on all of this effort to create this carbon and organic-rich soil and you leave it bare, the winter rains will surely wash away all of that fertile soil. And so in order to preserve all the effort and carbon you've been storing and working to build up in your soil, it's imperative that you cover it with this nice layer of mulch. And mulch can be anything. It doesn't have to be the typical things you think of. I use anything that's free and available, from grass, straw. You know, this time of year in the fall, there's so many leaves around. I go around to my neighbors and I, you know, offer to rake their leaves for them, and then I can go bring them in my garden to mulch it.
Uh-huh.
And that
nice.
Way you're not spending all these resources, you know, buying, you know, expensive store-bought mulch. You know, part of the idea of carbon farming is to use what you have.
Uh-huh. And what about cover crops?
So I play around with cover crops. My one issue with cover crops, they do an unbelievable job of protecting the soil, nourishing the soil, preventing erosion. But sometimes on a home gardener scale, they can be a little overwhelming, especially if you're not relying on a rototiller.
Right.
So I've cover cropped in the past directly into my beds, but had a difficult spring kind of removing that cover crop if it wasn't an annual that died back naturally from the cold. With just the broad fork, and then, you know, you'd plant, and then you'd have, you know, kind of clover popping up all in your lettuce, so when you went to harvest, it was a little difficult, and it's by no means a bad thing to share your space with cover crops, but I've over the years have moved away from cover cropping my direct planting beds, and in turn have mulched them, but what I do still cover crop are my pathways that I walk on.
Uh-huh.
Because you get all of the benefits of cover cropping for the soil, but it's not as readily in your way as it can be.
I see. And then do you leave it in the spring when it's, you know, when you come back to it, or do you then cover your walkways with cardboard and mulch?
I do both. So depending on, you know, because as you know, gardening can be a lot of work, and you can never do everything you want to do. So for tasks like that, I try to cycle them back and forth. So if I see the cover crops doing a good job and it's not getting too out of control, I'll leave it, especially the clover, because the bees love the flowers and it gives them something to eat. But if it starts to grow out of control and I need to kind of tame it down, I will do the whole sheet mulch again and cover it with cardboard and cover it with usually a wood chip mulch.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so when I've cover cropped, you know, I guess I cover crop and then I will turn, I don't dig the whole soil up, but I will turn it over or, you know, fold it in.
Mm-hmm.
Is that doing more damage by stirring up the soil than the benefit of cover cropping?
In short, I would say yes. I don't think it's necessarily going to take back all the positive impacts of growing your own food. But in general practice, you know, leaving the soil profile, so, you know, the soil surface down to the bedrock intact in its natural order of things is the best for the community of soil organisms that live there.
Uh-huh. So even when you're putting compost into the soil, you don't turn it in and, like, mix it up. You kind of just put it on top and let nature take care of it.
And I might take a spring rake and gently start to scratch it in. But over the season, you'll start to see, if you pull back where you laid your compost down on your native soil, you'll start to see soil organisms naturally mixing it in for you.
Uh-huh.
And that's the beauty of cultivating all of these critters under the ground, is that in the end they end up doing the work for you, so that gardening actually becomes easier in the long term.
Uh-huh. Right. And what do you say about composting? How do people get started in composting? We're almost out of time, so we have just a few minutes, but I just want to touch on composting. How do you recommend people build their compost?
So I've been composting for a long time, and I've kind of gotten pretty, relaxed about it. I think that there is this really important, very specific science involved, but I think that can overwhelm the everyday person. So my general rule of thumb is either whether it's an outdoor bin made of hay bales or wood or one of those tumbler, you know, black tumbler things you can buy. As long as you keep a 50% ratio of green to a 50% ratio of brown, brown being, leaves, straw, those are the carbon-rich. The green is the nitrogen-rich, being your food scraps, grass clippings, stuff like that. If you just keep an equal ratio of those, you should be all right. Your compost might not get as hot as if you were following, you know, a recipe by the book, but it's kind of that simple nitty-gritty way to just get started and to start generating some compost for your garden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I do so much cooking, my compost that's near my house is really
handy.
It's just vegetable. And then, you know, at the end of the summer, I take all that, and it's a really disgusting job because it's quite smelly at that point.
It gets slimy, yep.
Yeah, and I bring it all out into my field where I have a big compost thing, and that's where then I layer it, kind of like when you were talking about, you know, how you build up your soil. I kind of do that to build up my compost, and I'll make a lasagna at that point with the leaves and the grass clippings and the food and the leaves and the manure. My friend, I have horse manure, gets dropped off here all the time, and that sits. And then I, you know, I create a lasagna thing, and, you know, and then build up a big compost pile that way and then cover it. And then I usually let it sit for like 6 months because I do add manure to it. And
yep.
I want to make sure that
I've had definitely some uh-oh moments realizing that very green manure also contains many, many, many weed seeds.
Right, right. Yeah, I've had that problem as well. So, Acadia, can you share with everyone who's listening how they can find your books?
Sure. So our books, or my books, are available at my publisher's website, stonepierpress.org. You can also order them through my own personal website, acadiatucker.com. And, of course, you can always find them on Amazon just by typing the title of the book in.
Wonderful. And I'll have a link on my website for those of you listening. If you just don't remember any of that or you didn't write it down, just go to my website and I will have the links there. Katie, I want to thank you so much, and I look forward to you coming down and speaking to our Slow Food chapter sometime in the near future.
Absolutely.
And good luck making it through another New England winter.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day. And everyone out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week. Bye for now.